From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest today, writer-director Craig Zobel, has had a taste of Sundance. Working with his friend David Gordon Green, who of course had All the Real Girls there, he's there for the first time this year on his own with a really terrific comedy, Great World of Sound, that's part comedy, part drama, and also a look at the South in a way we don't often see the South. Craig, first of all, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a really benevolent look at the South. Well, one thing that really struck me is that nobody has the same accent and speaks at the same rate, which is what you always get in Sundance movies where people are from, quote unquote, the South.
Yeah, I mean, the South, especially places like Charlotte, which is where the film is like set and where we shot, and but also like Atlanta and several different places, you know, there's so many people that move there. There's like a lot of activity going on there. I felt like that you never see movies that are about the South that handle it like that, that talk about it in present tense almost, you know? It's oftentimes like there is still a lot of like overalls and well, Spanish moss. And,
you know what I mean? Like, it's either like Hicks working on trucks or somebody's about to be lynched.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there's this sort of new business South that I was fascinated with, you know, like that I think is like definitely down there. And
yeah. Oh, sure. The South of those strip malls and those mortar courts, that is a big part of this movie. And so many of those rooms feel like those rooms in those prefab hotels that are all over places like Charlotte and what I think was being the new South, that area that's around the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And it's funny because even some people have mentioned like, wow, were you trying to kind of look retro with like some of your production design? And I'm always like, no, it just that stuff really looks still, you know, people like remodeled in like 1988. And then that's what it looks like.
You should tell what the movie's about.
Yeah, sure. It's about a talent scout sort of scheme that happens in this case in the music business, where these guys get hired to become record producers, A&R scouts for a small independent record label, and they're sent around kind of on business trips around the South to different towns, in which the record labels put ads in a local newspaper advertising basically want ads saying, do you have what it takes to be a famous musician? You know, we're coming seeking undiscovered acts for our record label, and please audition. And so, you know, they go and set up in these hotel rooms, and they ask like musicians to come into the hotel rooms and perform for them and you know, play the music. And at some point during the course of the audition, they remind them that in order to really make it, they'll need a professional sounding demo tape, and that's going to cost, you know, the musician some money, but that they think that they have what it takes to be a star, and if the musician will put some money into it, then they'll certainly make it big.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Craig Zobel. His film, his first as director-writer, is, of course, Great World of Sound. Now, how did you find your two leads for the film?
Well, the character of Martin, which was played by Pat Healy, I met Pat through actually one of David Gordon Green's films, Undertow. He had a small role in that film, and you know, it was a role that he brought a lot to in improv, and I just remembered him and remembered how kind of funny and what a strong actor he was. And so I didn't necessarily write the role for him, but like upon sort of like finishing the script, I thought of him pretty early on and wanted to talk to him about it. As far as Kenny Holiday, who plays Clarence, the other lead in the film, I very literally like found him through an audition process where a casting director kind of put us together. So
we should say the people who watch television will know Kenny Holiday as,
yes,
as the guy who basically sort of stood by and did nothing. One of the interchangeable black guys on Matlock for many years.
Exactly.
And before that was the black guy who stood by and didn't do much on a show called Carter Country in the late 70s. And so getting a chance to sit, this is one of these things where you can tell an actor has waited his entire career for a role, and he really bites into it. There's a lot of sort of ambition underserved for many years that goes into his acting, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. He's an incredibly talented guy. Like, he walked into the room and sort of, like, blew me away and was very energized to do specifically this part. You know, he'd read the whole script
And I think you're kind of right. I mean, he had played, you know, sort of the guy who at the last, you know, 5 minutes of the Matlock episode, you know, would come in with the one piece of information and say, like, you know, hey, Matlock, they did this, you know. And I think that he was excited to be able to explore something more. And but I also, I mean, he brought a lot to it. He gave me like an amazing gift of a really good performance. Like he absorbed a lot of this character and was really able to like dig into it, and it was, I mean, he was terrific to work with. So
the one of the things that strikes me about this is, for both him and for you, the movie in a way kind of sort of is kind of a working autobiography. I mean, I know parts of this that you said came from your dad's life, but also you can tell that Kenny probably had a few jobs like this or auditions like this himself. And in fact, the movie to me is kind of like watching what it must be like to watch actors audition. And it's kind of horrifying in that respect.
No, it's funny that you say, I mean, we talked about that almost every day. Like that was definitely resonated with both him and Pat Healy, like that this was sort of, they understood this experience firsthand, you know.
Because we should say there are a series of musicians, aspiring musicians, who are coming into their hotel rooms where they are set up shop with their songs and playing their songs for them live or singing in the rooms.
Exactly. And they play the song, and then it's up to the two actors to kind of turn it into more of a sales pitch from it being an audition, you know. And actually, it's funny, you know, like both Pat and Kenny both also had sort of some sales experience in different ways too. You know what I mean? Like, we've all done jobs, and myself included. Like, I've worked at you know, telemarketing and sort of like other, you know, nefarious sort of like like jobs that you hate to admit that you did, but you did because you need money at some point, you know. And so like it was kind of the end of every day in shooting those portions of the film where we would all kind of look around and be like, yeah, this is like we responded, you know, directly to it ourselves, definitely. So.
And I wonder how the dynamic worked out, because Pat is often kind of half-hearted unless he has some actual belief in the person, his character, unless Martin believes in the guy, the person who's there, whereas Clarence is just willing to sell and do anything. I mean, and I wonder how you as a director decided on that dynamic.
I think that was kind of where me and Ken hit it off immediately, was that we kind of like decided that as a character, you know, Clarence would be a kind of guy who could look at this sort of thing and say, like, okay, I understand that this is a job. This beats like a lot of other jobs that I've done. You know, he sort of saw through the A&R like research and like scouting kind of aspect very quickly.
We're talking to the writer-director of the new film, Great World of Sound, Craig Zobel. I'm Elvis Mitchell as the treatment. I guess I find myself wondering, because often the films, I think, of David Gordon Green's, that sort of that North Carolina kind of school of film, it seems to be about discovering the story through the characters. And I wonder if that's something that's kind of a way that he works and you work too, or if you found a different way to work, or because I know that you're friends, you've worked with him before. I wonder how you found your way as a director in this.
I guess I consider this to be a character-driven piece as well. You know, this was also like maybe more conceptual in a certain way, in that I knew that we wanted to talk about. I knew I wanted to like make a movie about this song sharking, which is what they call like the scam.
And did your dad actually do this kind of thing?
Yeah, my dad. He was a DJ, an AM DJ, and he moved somewhere and there wasn't any like actual DJ work available at the time, and he kind of fell into answering an ad, just like the main character at the beginning of the film does, to be a talent scout, and thought that it was a legitimate thing. So like he did kind of go through this, and that was like my main I guess question at the beginning of wanting to make the movie was, you know, he did something that ultimately, once you break it down to its like parts, it's a scam. You know, and he was the one perpetrating this scam. but he's a good guy. You know, like he, like I know my dad inside and out as, you know, as much as a son can know his dad, I guess. And I don't know him to be a guy who would want to or feel comfortable scamming someone. So I guess that kind of conundrum, like how did he end up doing this? Like he must have been sort of in some way scammed as well, or like also justified it in some way. You know, like I think at a certain level, like if you need money enough, you can kind of sell yourself that you're doing something okay, you know, like you can find the upside, so to speak, to like something that is not necessarily a positive thing to do simply because you need to make money. And I thought that was really interesting. So I always kind of wanted to start there. And then it was like, how do we tell the story? I think it did kind of turn into like what kind of a guy would end up there, and sort of like we did try to root it in character as, you know, as much as possible.
Because what's makes so interesting about doing it like that is that for a while, at least the first half hour, it's not entirely clear if these guys are scamming or not, or if, or more importantly, they don't know that they're really scamming.
I mean, they don't know necessarily.
Which, and I wonder, because that's a really interesting dramatic decision to make, because it's not Glengarry Glen Ross where they're like the relish of scamming somebody. The fact is, because of the desperation of both of these guys, and many of the people fall into this circle, it's probably better for them to delude themselves.
Yeah. It's probably like the only way that they could do it, you know, like the film opens with shots of a gold record being spray painted based on some sort of like in even in like making the film and talking with like the crew that worked on the film, like people sort of commenting like, when do they learn that it's a scam? Or that I wanted to make sure that as an audience member, you weren't sitting there going like, well, is it a scam? It seems like a scam. Like, I mean, I just kind of wanted it to be about the way that people maybe justify things in their lives. You know what I mean? Like, more than it being specifically, like, this mystery of whether or not it was legit or not. You know, like, I didn't want that to be, like, a centerpiece of the conversation.
Sure, but what it turns out is that the protagonists are just as hungry and desperate as the people who are auditioning for them.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the parallel to draw, was that these people that are auditioning, like, are not really any different, almost. The talent scouts themselves are even sort of auditioning at the beginning for the job, you know?
Which is really funny, because it makes these guys both predators and prey, and we don't really ever have a sense for it, because you obviously chose, you and your writing partner chose to not make it judgmental about them. The business, you clearly is bad, but the guys who are doing it aren't necessarily bad people.
I think that when I was writing the very first draft of the script in 2001,
It goes back that far.
Yeah. I wrote kind of a draft that was like very large and unwieldy, and sometime around 2003, asked George Smith to help me kind of make it into he's an old friend, and he's also like one of the best writers I know, to kind of help me like refine it, because I couldn't see the forest through the trees of like a bunch of stories that I'd heard from my dad and whatnot. But back even at the very, very beginning of like trying to kind of conceive of the idea, it was when I was shopping for my first car that I was ever going to buy, just coincidentally. And I kind of came into, you know, like going onto a car lot, you can go into the car lot for the first day and like not intentionally be going there to like, I'm just looking today, is like simply what you're doing. But you will like, you will get put into a little room, and you will get like very highly pressured by people like, what is it going to take today for you to leave here, you know, with this car? And I thought, I would remember walking away like angry at the car salesman. But that's not fair to the car salesman. They are just trying to make a living. You know what I mean? Like, and I guess that was something that I really wanted to be in the movie, was, you know, that it's like, as angry as maybe kind of the job can be, like for the people doing it, like they've found a way to make it okay for themselves. And it was hard for me to like judge that in a super harsh light. Although I think that in some ways, like the film does comment on like whether or not it's a good
Oh, it doesn't let them off the hook, but still, it's not easy moralizing. We'll take a break. My guest is writer-director Craig Zobel. His first film is Great World of Sound. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Thank you.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm talking to Craig Zobel. His first film as writer-director is Great World of Sound. I know you talked about documentaries, but it feels a lot like an Altman film to me, too, in that way that Altman kind of unfolds and these people who you think are going to be minor kinds of people turn out to play a much bigger part, like the girl who's written the anthem. I mean, to me, it feels to me like, I don't know how familiar you are with Nashville, but it feels very much like Nashville to me.
Oh, I'm a big fan. That era of Robert Altman movies, I think, was like watched by a lot of people involved in the project. Specifically also just in sort of like camera work and look, like we made the film on a very small budget and there was kind of, I felt, things that were both like fresh to watch and exciting in movies like, you know, The Long Goodbye or something style-wise, but are also ways to do something economically and quickly and kind of like be able to shoot it. And so like the sort of the look of it almost kind of was, we were watching it for, like you said, watching Nashville and things like this for kind of thematic reasons. And then it occurred to me that this is like actually a good way to do this kind of stuff, you know, that it really would work for it. You know, everybody talks about Robert Altman and overlapping dialogue. And I don't mean to like beat a dead horse, but it really is like fresh feeling when you, I can't believe that it didn't like take on and like that all movies didn't sort of like absorb that. But still people, you know, when you do that, when you have people overlap dialogue, when you have characters talk like real people instead of like movie people, it does always kind of feel like, I don't know, more alive to me. And so, I mean, that was definitely an influence, like in a major way.
But I guess I thought an influence too in that way that each of the vignettes actually moves the story forward, you know, in that way where you don't get a sense of the plotting or the fact that the movie has kind of a structure until you get to a climax and we get a chance to see what's gone on before. And that scene must be crucial, the scene I'm talking about. It's a scene where a teenage girl who auditions comes into her father and sees this incredibly heartfelt sort of mashup of anthems that's so deeply felt that Martin responds to it and actually gets involved with the production of it.
Yeah.
That's a scene to me that really takes on a lot of weight throughout the movie and becomes a character-defining moment and also a moment that sort of defines a movie in terms of where it's going to go that we're not aware of as we're sitting through it.
Yeah, that was a really hard scene to shoot. I actually recently talked with Pat and we were kind of reminiscing over like the shoot itself and what the hardest parts were. And I really think that was one of the days that was the hardest. And it wasn't that we didn't know like what it was supposed to be. And it also wasn't that like sort of anything technically or anything in anyone's performance was off in a way that made it difficult to shoot. But it was, we sort of started to realize that it was so much about looks and like just very small subtle things, like how do we sell the audience that this song will change this guy, you know, like what about this scenario is like making this guy kind of like decide to change his stance on like where he is in the company, you know what I mean, what he's doing right now. It was definitely like, I think me and Pat, like for the two of us, like oddly harder than other parts of the movie to make sure that like rang as true as we could make it, I guess.
And how did you find the other actors, the girl and the man who plays her father for that scene?
I cast a bunch of people locally in Charlotte, and I met them through local casting in Charlotte. Mahari Constant, who plays the little girl, she is a terrific operatic singer.
And I think that because she has such breath control. I mean, she can sing the entire stanza without taking a breath, which is incredible.
She was really
to watch.
Amazing. Yeah, she was really amazing. I mean, I think that she I think that she listened to the song that we wanted her to sing and was just like, what is this? You know, like, I think that she was a little like, kind of like, okay, I guess I'll sing that. But she did it great. She did it great. And Willie Stafford, who played her father in the film, was a local actor. He had kind of worked with some of the other crew in the production, and they were like, he kind of came highly recommended and really did a great job.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Craig Zobel. We're talking about his new film, his first as writer director, Great World of Sound. That piece, and so many of those pieces, those performers would come in, and there's so many different kinds of music. And one of the things that's kind of interesting to me, too, and I didn't really notice anybody talking about this in the interviews that you did beforehand, was how you cast the different types of music that come through. Because I expect there to be a more of a concentration on singer-songwriter kind of stuff that we – or things we think of as being singer-songwriter. And there's all kinds of stuff in it.
I have to sort of admit that I think that maybe in these real song sharking scams, it's a little bit more weighted towards simply singer-songwriters than I chose to kind of make it. But, you know, but on the other hand, that's not 100% true. Like, it's strange.
Because the one thing that sort of I was touched by is that even though it feels like the logical film to make in the era of American Idol, these aren't the kind of people who would audition for American Idol, which I liked about the movie.
Good, yeah. I mean, I wasn't trying to, like, stay away from the American Idol, like, thing necessarily, but I honestly can't say that, like, I was watching American Idol as, like, a reference point to the movie in a certain way. So it was, like, I'm not so sure that the people that answer ads like this are necessarily people that are, like, the sort of pop singers that you see on that show. You know what I mean? Like, these are people that do feel like they are songwriters, in a sense, often. And then bands a lot. I mean, there was a lot of...
That's what surprised me. There were so many bands. So it wasn't just a guy with the... Even though there is one guy with a guitar who plays his own trumpet...
Right.
But there are a lot more bands, a lot more sort of configurations of people than, and which is interesting to watch, interesting to shoot, and yeah. Also sort of breaks up what might be the possible monotony of having a bunch of people troop in with their guitars and then walk out.
Exactly. And I think it's like not 100% like untrue in that a lot of people will like form a band and kind of play locally and like not know how to connect to the, for lack of a better word, legit music world, like how to get a record produced. You know what I mean?
That's not just a place like that where there are people who probably don't even know anybody who knows anybody who knows somebody who's a musician. Yeah. Where else would you turn?
Yeah, exactly.
Because one of the characters, somebody who actually leads to a crisis point and the real climax of the movie, is somebody who works in a bar, but she doesn't sing at the bar. And when we go into the bar, there's no music playing, which I thought was kind of a fascinating choice to make too.
Yeah, and there's not very many people at the bar either. It's supposed to be like kind of an old, like it was described in the movie as
an old
person's
bar. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Phenomenon I know all too well. I guess, too, one of the things that I find myself thinking about, too, and I wanted to ask you this, is that as Martin is talking about all the different things that he's done, he could almost be one of these people, at some point in his life, he might have been one of these people coming in to audition.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that was sort of written into his character, is that he's a guy who's had a lot of hobbies and sort of always looking for what it is going to be that's going to make sense as, you know, going to make sense as what he's going to do with his life. You know, that he's, like, still searching that out. And he's, like, in his 30s, but still, like, kind of trying to figure that out, which is kind of true of, I don't know, a lot of me.
I think you found a calling now, though. I don't know how to break it to you. But it's fascinating that almost most of the people in who are coming into audition, for the most part, they aren't driven, even though they may not be very talented, most of them aren't driven to be in the music business. It's kind of the thing that they sort of want to do. It's not they're saying, I want more than anything to be a star. And that's where the real sales and sort of taking advantage takes sort of comes into play.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's a lot of people that have interest, if not talent.
Like, some vague notion that if they pursued this, something could happen. But I expect it, and I was sort of pleased that doesn't happen, that there's one person who walks in and just says, I've got to do this. That doesn't really happen here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that would be a little disingenuous. I think that, like, some sort of bells go off in almost anybody when you start having to pay money. You do need to be kind of convinced, like, you know, of course it's going to cost money. This, you need to be convinced of that, you know, like in order to actually like fork over dollars. So I was a little hesitant. I don't think like smarts and gullibility even. I mean, I think that it's about, you know, people like this being something that they feel, like you said, feel like it could actually happen if they pursued it. And then at the same time, it being something that they would wish could happen, pay some money and be like, well, I'll roll the dice on this, you know?
And just watching the way the world works, and it seemed to me to be as much a comment on sort of what we expect of art or what art's supposed to do for us in this country as anything else. Is there something that just sort of came to you or helped to crystallize the movie that you were working on as you spent more time on film sets and watching movies be made?
I can only say that I guess I was at a place in working behind the scenes on movies where I was having fun and it was cool and it was interesting, and what I was doing was very like making sure all of the equipment was there in time for the shoot to happen type stuff, which is not, you know, very sexy, but is very important to happen. And it was interesting and fun, but it was also, I think I was at a place right before I made the film where I was starting to question whether or not it was like something that I needed to be doing anymore. This was kind of pointed out to me by friends after seeing a cut, you know, early cuts of the movie, was that it was sort of what Martin's trying to do, something like take a stab at something, and what all the people who come in are trying to do is to like take a stab at something, like, well, I'm just going to try this and see if it actually works, was kind of like me saying, well, I want to at least try to direct a movie one time and see if I can kind of change what I'm doing, because I'm like, you know, not necessarily in a happy place.
You're listening to The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. I'm talking to writer-director Craig Zobel about his first film, Great World of Sound. One of the things that I sort of get from the movie is that each one of these people who's coming in to audition has this story. And it's kind of fascinating to see at what point the guys, the protagonists, are going to be taken in by these stories enough to kind of just get lost in them. So it becomes a kind of a little tension in each one of these vignettes. When are they going to ring the bell and say, are you going to buy?
Right. I'm amazed that these people are able to do this, the actual people that do this on a daily basis, like that they're able to kind of do it. Like it is in the film, I should say, is that oftentimes they really think that they're doing something legitimate. And so they're kind of being pressured to like, don't forget, we need some money, because like no matter how good they are, and no matter how bad they are, no matter how sad it is, no matter how exciting it is, like ultimately, like we need to keep the doors open too, guys. You know, like that kind of tone to it.
What's fascinating, though, now you must have thought this too as you were making it, that given the kinds of 70s movies that obviously influence you about sort of like marginal losers trying to sort of keep their, make their place in the world and figure out their place is, that this movie hadn't really been made before. A movie about
it,
this.
It was fascinating to me. I felt excited that we were going to make it, because I felt like I couldn't believe that it kind of hadn't already been told, or something very similar hadn't been told. You know what I mean? Like, and I have before said, like, salesman about Bible salesman, but that's a documentary. You know what I mean? Like, it's different.
But that's very different. I mean, that's also, even though they're hustlers, they believe in what they're doing, even though they're kind of down and out, or they, at least they talk themselves into it. But then this moral meter is moving constantly. And that's what's so fascinating about this. I think, wow, this is really an original piece of work.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot.
I'm sorry. You're a director now, Craig. I don't know how to break it to you.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks again for doing this.
Thanks a lot, Elvis.
My guest is first-time writer-director Craig Zobel. His first film is Great World of Sound. Our technical director and editor at KCRW in Santa Monica is Bob Carlson, with assistance from Paul Ruist at Argo Networks in New York. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.